listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, February 16th, 2021. I'm Annika Hurd from Drake University, and here is our first story. High schoolers boost IWCC spring enrollment. Iowa Western Community College's spring enrollment is up compared to last spring, mainly because of a jump in high school students taking courses from the college. The student population increased by 215 students, or 4.2%, from spring 2020, according to a report presented by the Board of Trustees Monday by Don Kohler, Vice President of Marketing, Enrollment Services, and Information Technology. Credit hours are up 1,271.5 credits, or 2.6%. Without high school students, enrollment would have slipped by 104 students, or 3%, and 1,062 credit hours, or 2.8%. However, an increase of 319, or 17.7%, in high school students taking 2,333.5, or 27.7% more credit hours boosted the overall total. Quote, "As of last week, the trend's okay, but there's still a lot of information out there," Kohler said. On high school, Lewis Central's on trimesters, so we won't know their numbers for a while. Overall, I think we're holding pretty good this semester. A lot of it's the high school students. Only the Council Bluffs campus tallied an increase, a modest bump of 13 students and 189 credit hours, or 0.4% and 0.5% respectively. The other centers lost anywhere from 10 students and 97 credit hours at the Page-Fremont County Center to 24 students and 289 hours at the Cass County Center. It should be noted that these numbers do not include high school students. Quote, "Maybe your centers aren't as bad as they look right here, because we put the high schoolers in one group," President Daniel Kinney said. There may be ways to recharge the centers. Kinney said he would like to develop a five-year plan for the centers. Iowa Western's full-time enrollment slipped by 32 students, or 2%, with a corresponding dip in full-time students' credit hours of 510, or 2%. These numbers do not include any non-credit students or classes, Kohler said. Quote, "We have a lot of people on campus doing things and paying that aren't included here," Board President Connie Hornbeck said. The academic area that showed the most growth was career and technical programs. Enrollment was up by 162 students, or 10%, with credit hours increasing by 1,284.65 credits, or 7%. Non-degree-seeking enrollment was up by 199 students, or 11%, but credit hours were down by 8,940.5 hours, or 44%. Of course, spring 2020 was not a typical semester. Iowa Western went online with most of its classes beginning March 30th, making exceptions for some career technical courses that depend on hands-on lab work. College officials encouraged students to go home if they could, to limit their risk of exposure to the novel coronavirus. However, the college did keep its housing facilities open for international students and others who could not go home. The Dr. John and Jean Marshall Wellness Center closed, and the Art Center events were canceled. On to our next story. Tis the Lenten season. With COVID-19 adjustments, Bluffs Catholic churches move forward with fish fries and shrimp boils. Fish fry season will look a little different this year, but at least we'll have one. Three Council Bluffs Catholic churches still plan to serve up the good stuff, fried fish for two, boiled shrimp at another, plus the fixins. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, only two of the churches are doing takeout with only this Lenten season. St. Patrick Catholic Church will offer a dine-in option. Corpus Christi Parish Queen of Apostles Church, 3304 4th Avenue, will have three takeout fish fries during Lent, with the first Friday along with March 5th and March 26th. Tickets are $10 per person and can be purchased over the phone at 712-323-2916. The church's Knights of Columbus Council will be pre-selling tickets after Masses as well. Quote, "There isn't a limit on ticket sales," said Brian Bowers with the church. "It would be helpful, though, if people could buy their tickets in advance." Pickup times are separated into three blocks, 4:30 p.m. to 5:30 p.m., 5:30 p.m. to 6 p.m., and 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. St. Peter's Church bucked the trend when it started its shrimp boils. This year, they'll host just one, a takeout affair on March 12th. Traditionally, the church has hosted two boils each year. Organizer Jeremy Brocklesby, with the church's Knights of Columbus Council, said because of the pandemic and turnout of around 300 people in recent years, a takeout event was the right move. Quote, it's kind of hard to tell people, especially when you're going to a volunteer-run service, you can't be here. It's easier to do a drive-through event instead of putting the rules and stipulations, Brocklesby said, of not wanting to put volunteers in the position of turning people away or making sure people follow precaution. Like all churches, St. Peter's is hopeful an in-person event will resume next year. Brocklesby said the boil has caught on beyond the church congregation in the past few years. Brocklesby and his wife, Lacey, both have a culinary background and now spearhead the menu. This year's haul will include shrimp, dirty rice, potatoes, macaroni and cheese, coleslaw, and cookies. Kids will get fish sticks, mac and cheese, and cookies. Quote, it's just something different, Jeremy Brocklesby said of going the shrimp route. Out of all the Knights of Columbus councils I've seen, everybody did a fish fry. No one did a shrimp boil. The cost is $15 for adults and $6 for children. Order form information is available at the St. Peter's Catholic Church Facebook page, or drop off an order after Sunday Mass. Pickup times are from 5:30 to 6 p.m., 6 to 6:30 p.m., and 6:30 to 7 p.m. And at St. Patrick Catholic Church, 4 Valley View Drive will have fish fries every Friday through Lent, February 19th through March 26th. The church hosted its inaugural fish fries last year before being cut short by the pandemic. This year, the fish fries will run from 5 to 8 p.m. with limited dine-in seating and a to-go option. Quote, we will keep dine-in seating to about 100 people, St. Patrick's Church business manager Darren Hecker said. Tickets are $12 for adults, $6 for kids ages 5 to 12 years old, and kids under 5 are free. Tickets will not be sold in advance. Guests pay at the fish fry. Next, Tab Hydration works to fill niche in local market. A recently opened Council Bluffs business is upping the ante in regard to ensuring its patrons are feeling their absolute best. Since opening in November 2020, Tab Hydration, 320 McKenzie Avenue, Suite number 201, has provided its customers in the greater Council Bluffs, Omaha metro area with an assortment of intravenous drip therapies extended to maximize overall health and wellness. Though there are a handful of similar businesses in Omaha, April Blackburn, who co-owns the operation with Jill Hunt, Nick Hunt, and John Nelson, said it's something needed and new locally. Blackburn noted many people are often in a state of dehydration without knowing it. The business's services can help address that. Quote, a lot of people don't really know this, Blackburn said, and they experience symptoms such as fatigue or irritability or brain fog, maybe bloating, and those things that people would never really contribute to being dehydrated, and they think it's just normal to feel that way. So really, the premise behind Tap Hydration. Starting at $115, the business provides various IV solutions designed to help customers feel their best in approximately 40 to 45 minutes. The cocktails, according to information provided on the Tap Hydration website, contain a variety of vitamins and essential minerals, among other things. To see a full list of IV treatments or to book an appointment, visit taphydration.com. In addition to drip therapy, Blackburn noted that Tap Hydration also offers Botox and Juvederm sessions and employs an esthetician. Quote, we have an amazing in-house esthetician. Her name is Marcia Mesher, Blackburn said. She has been an esthetician and practicing in the community for many years. She's a really big staple in the community, has an incredible business, and does some really great work. Prior to jumpstarting her new venture, Blackburn said she served 12 years as a registered nurse doing hospital work, followed by a few years working in case management for a home health company. Jill Hunt, Blackburn said, works as the business's medical director and works full-time as a licensed nurse practitioner. The duo's medical backgrounds and certifications enable them to operate a business requiring the insertion of needles into veins, Blackburn added. So far, Blackburn said business has been steady. It's a unique business in the fact, she said, that many people don't know what they're missing out on until they try it. Much like with chiropractic, many patients don't visit until they are already showing adverse symptoms. She encourages those interested to schedule an appointment before they are experiencing severe hydration from something like a long night out and the resulting morning of self-inflicted suffering. Quote, we consider this to be a CAM therapy, a complementary and alternative therapy to health, Blackburn said. It's crazy, because a lot of people just don't know how good they could actually feel, and we want them to experience that. It's been exciting for us to bring a concept to Council Bluffs that Council Bluffs hasn't seen before. Next, officials backtrack on plan to withhold vaccine from 5 counties. Iowa health officials have reversed a decision to withhold COVID-19 vaccines from some counties that were reported not having used up to 80% of their allocation last week. The Iowa Department of Public Health informed five counties on Friday that it would withhold this week's allotment of vaccine. The decision drew criticism from several county health administrators who said either that the state was mistaken or that the bad weather has temporarily slowed their progress. The announcement followed a new state rule requiring the use of at least 80% of a county's vaccine allotment. The rule is designed to reduce the amount of vaccine sitting in storage. As of Monday, three counties, Buchanan, Washington, and Chickasaw, reported that state officials had informed them that they would be getting their allotment of vaccines this week, the Des Moines Register reported. Ty Burkhart, director of the Buchanan County Health Department, said her county actually had used at least 80% of its allotment last week, but that because of one of its vaccination clinics was held on Friday, state officials who had used Thursday figures thought the county was behind. Iowa's current focus in its vaccination efforts is on seniors, teachers, and child health care workers, police and firefighters. By midday Monday, state officials reported that 355,703 people had received at least one dose needed for full protection. In Pottawatomie County, 5,630 residents had received the first dose, and 2,857 have received the second dose, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data. Providers in the county have administered 8,199 first doses and 5,649 second doses. The second of three scheduled vaccination clinics for Pottawatomie County residents 65 and older is planned for Friday. The county had originally planned on 1,100 doses, but that number has been bumped to 1,195 doses, according to Pottawatomie County Public Health. Connections Area Agency on Aging is coordinating the additional appointments. At 3 p.m. Monday, the state reported 9,598 total positive cases of COVID-19 in the county out of 43,570 individuals tested, with 8,869 recoveries. There were 46 new cases, 51 new tests, and 53 new recoveries reported over the weekend and into Monday. Next, Reynolds proposes ethanol mandate. Governor Kim Reynolds is proposing Iowa's very own ethanol mandate. The proposal has drawn unusual lines in the lobbying sand, with renewable fuels groups pitted against gas stations, and at least one conservative, free market-minded advocacy organization. Reynolds' proposal, which she introduced in legislation on Monday, is similar in spirit to the federal ethanol mandate, which requires a certain number of gallons of corn-based ethanol to be blended into the nation's fuel supply. Reynolds' proposal would require all gasoline sold in Iowa to contain at least 10% ethanol, with an option for the governor to raise that to 15% in 4 years. The proposal also shifts existing tax credits for ethanol and other biofuels to use only those with blends higher than the new baseline. That move is expected to reduce state spending, and some of those savings would be dedicated to a fund that retailers could access to help pay for equipment upgrades that would need to accommodate the new higher blend ethanol fuels. Quote, the legislation would invest significantly into Iowa's renewable fuel infrastructure program, boost farm income, reduce emissions, and put millions of dollars back into the state's general fund, Reynolds said in a statement. Quote, it is time for Iowa to take charge of our renewable fuel economy and stand up against the inconsistency we continue to see from Washington, D.C. and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. Renewable fuels groups often offered praise for the sweeping proposal after it was introduced Monday, but the legislation also has drawn strong opposition from gas stations and truck stops that say they would need expensive new storage equipment, and from organizations that claim the proposal eliminates consumer choice at the pump. The legislation's breadth and the myriad of groups supporting it and opposing it promise to make for an intensive and prolonged legislative debate. Reynolds' proposed legislation would require all gasoline in the state to include 10% ethanol, with the exceptions for one pump per retailer for ethanol-free gasoline. In 2025, the governor would have the option to bump the baseline requirement to 15% ethanol. Require all diesel fuel in the state to contain 5% biodiesel fuel from October through March and 11% from April through September. In 2024, the April through September blend requirement would increase to 20%. Shift increasing tax credits to only blends above the new minimum standards. require any new equipment installed in the state to be compliant with 15% ethanol or 20% biodiesel usage. The Iowa Renewable Fuels Association projects the governor's proposal would increase ethanol use by 117 million gallons and biodiesel by 203 million gallons, which the association says would boost demand for Iowa corn and soybeans. The association also projects the shift in tax credits would produce a net reduction of $87.5 million in state spending over 5 years. The state's nonpartisan fiscal analysis agency has not yet analyzed the governor's proposal to produce a projected impact on the state budget. Quote, "When you take a step back and look at it from a broad view, this bill will boost our rural economy," said Monty Shaw, executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. He said the legislation would help renewable fuel producers be good for farmers and commodity prices, reduce carbon emissions, and be good for consumers. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley would say it's good, good, good. Not everyone agrees. A coalition of retailers, wholesalers, fuel distributors, transportation groups, and more have formed the Fuel Choice Coalition for the specific purpose of opposing the governor's legislation. The coalition includes popular gas station chains like Casey's, Come and Go, and Quickstar, as well as the Iowa chapter Americans for Prosperity, which advocates for free market policies. The coalition issued a statement calling Reynolds' proposal, quote, "a strict mandate on the fuel industry that eliminates choice, raises fuel prices on consumers, and harms rural Iowa businesses." Americans for Prosperity, Casey's, and Come and Go, or their owners, spent tens of thousands of dollars working to get Reynolds elected in 2018, and rarely are they on the other side of the legislative lobbying table from the Republican governor. This time is different. Perhaps in no small part due to the fact that the coalition believes the required equipment upgrades will cost Iowa retailers a collective $1 billion. Quote, "Fuel Iowa agrees renewable fuels like ethanol and biodiesel are critical to our economy. We have long shared a goal to expand our infrastructure to move more biofuels across the state," Ronald N. Langston, president and CEO of the organization that represents businesses across a spectrum of Iowa's fuel industry, said in a statement. "However, approaching this issue by way of a government-imposed mandate is the wrong road for Iowa to take, and harmful consequences will follow. We strongly urge the legislature to oppose this mandate, which will force Iowans to pay more at the pump, eliminate choice in our fuels, and threaten hundreds of small businesses and the people they employ." Drew Klein, state director of Americans for Prosperity, said in a statement that the proposal moves away from consumer choice, quote, "and into artificial market manipulation bordering on a fuel mandate." Quote, "This is new regulation, not for the sake of public safety, but as a means of picking winners and losers in the economy," Klein said in a statement. Legislative leaders expressed their support for the renewable fuels industry in Iowa, but were hesitant to say they are prepared to support the governor's proposal. Republicans hold majorities in both the Iowa House and Senate, but this proposal could be that rare legislation that divides legislators, but not along political party lines. Quote, "The best answer I can give you at this point in time is I've had a lot of requests for different meetings from several different groups that are at the table on this one," said Pat Grassley, the Republican Iowa House Speaker from New Hartford. Quote, "We want to have those further conversations with them to get that input." Democratic Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls of Coralville said his colleagues believe new renewable fuels are a critical part of the state's economy and are looking at the governor's proposal. Todd Pritchard, leader of the House Democrats from Charles City, gave the most full-throated endorsement of the proposal. He said the legislation could help the state's renewable fuel industry recover from the impacts of former President Donald Trump's administration, which granted waivers that weakened the federal ethanol mandate. The governor's proposal will see its first legislative action this week, Wednesday, in a House subcommittee hearing. On to our next story. Despite census delays, Iowa legislature leaders begin redistricting processes. Iowa's once-a-decade legislative and congressional redistricting plan appears to be certain to be delayed because of U.S. Census Bureau holdups, but legislative leaders have started taking steps to move the process along. Delays caused by COVID-19 and the Trump administration's actions promoted the Bureau to say that Friday it has been again revised its time for releasing data the state will use to draw new maps in Iowa's four U.S. House districts and 50 state Senate districts, two of which will include two House districts. The census data will be made available by September 30th, 6 months later than its original March 31st release date, which previously was pushed out to July 30th. In 2011, the last time the legislature approved redistricting, the process was completed April 14th. The new timeline means Iowa won't get the data it needs until after the deadline for approving redistricting. If a redistricting plan isn't approved by September 1st, state law throws the issue into the Iowa Supreme Court to finalize before the end of the year. Quote, the realities of the pandemic, the Iowa Constitution, and the U.S. Constitution create a unique set of challenges, Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitmer, Republican of Ankeny, said Friday afternoon. At this time, the Senate is evaluating its options on how best to proceed and for the best possible paths forward for the redistricting process. Despite the delays, Whitmer and other legislative leaders began naming their appointees to the temporary redistricting advisory commission that will gather public input about the redistricting maps. Although Iowa will maintain 4 U.S. House seats, the boundaries will be redrawn to reflect population changes as determined by the decennial census. Likewise, those population changes will determine the new boundaries of legislative districts. Whitmer on Thursday named Chris Hagenow of Urbandale, his law firm partner and former House Majority Leader, as his representative. House Minority Leader Todd Pritchard, Democrat of Charles City, named Ian Russell, a Bettendorf lawyer, as his representative. Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, Democrat of Coralville, appointed Des Moines businesswoman Deirdre DeGeer. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican of New Hartford, was expected to name his appointee before Monday. In making his appointment, Walls expressed a Democratic concern that Republicans, who control both chambers of the legislature and the governor's office, will use the redistricting process to their advantage. Quote, now more than ever, we need to ensure Iowans have fair maps for legislative and congressional districts going into the 2022 election, he said. Iowa's nonpartisan independent system for redistricting should not be determined by politicians. Republicans also say they are committed to Iowa's model redistricting plan, but Democrats worry the majority party will reject the first two plans in order to amend the new maps to their advantage. Regardless of political intentions, the timeline for finalizing new maps is up in the air. Iowa law calls for the maps to be finalized by September 1st, but legislative staffers say that might have to be adjusted because of the delays in census data. Quote, there goes my summer, LSA legal counsel Ed Cook said when the Census Bureau said data would be delayed until July 30th. After Friday's announcement, he and his fellow LSA mapmakers may well be spending the fall creating one or more redistricting plans. Grassley had advised legislators that the delays likely meant there would be a special session, perhaps in August, to consider a redistricting plan. Now, that could be pushed back to October or later. Quote, the Temporary Redistricting Advisory Commission will have to jump right into action as soon as that first map comes out from LSA, Walls said. Within 14 days of the plan being delivered to the legislature, the commission must submit its summary of information and testimony from at least 3 public hearings across the state to gather Iowans' opinions on the plan. Then, lawmakers get 3 cracks at new maps. If they reject the first plan or an up-and-down vote without amendments, LSA has 35 days to draw another set of maps that addresses the reasons the legislature gave for rejecting the first. If that's not approved, the LSA has another 35 days to produce a third plan. Unlike the first two plans, legislatures can amend the third plan like they would any piece of legislation. That's where the Democrats are concerned Republicans could create maps that lock in their majorities for another decade. Republicans have called those fears, quote, far-left fantasies. Lawmakers have never been unable to meet the September 1st deadline for approving a redistricting plan. Legislatures leery of giving up control of the process to the court approved the first plan in 1991 and 2011, the second plan in 2001, and the third plan, without amendment, in 1981. Even then, the plans are subject to immediate review by the Supreme Court. In addition to a special session being an inconvenience for lawmakers, the delay will likely frustrate state and federal candidates and political parties as they plan for their 2022 campaigns. Candidate recruitment and fundraising, especially for non-incumbents, is more difficult if the boundary lines are unknown. All right, let's move on to the opinion section. When the White House can't handle the truth. On January 21st, President Biden's first full day in office, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki began her briefing with this. Quote, when the president asked me to serve in this role, we talked about the importance of bringing truth and transparency back to the briefing room, end quote. Now, the administration's position on opening schools shut down by COVID lockdowns is testing that pledge. Psaki's problem started on February 3rd when the White House COVID response team held a teleconference for the press. Among the group was Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the president's new choice to head the Centers for Disease Control. A reporter asked Walensky about the CDC's priorities for vaccination, and in particular, whether, quote, the federal government would be working more closely with states to get kind of more vaccinations to teachers, in particular, so that schools can reopen in the fall. Walensky said that a group inside the CDC, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, had created a priority list for those receiving vaccinations. In December, the committee included teachers in what was called the 1B category, meaning they would be among those who should be in the next line. But that wasn't law. It was the CDC's guidance for states to follow or not to follow. Quote, we've left that to the states to manage, Walensky explained. In terms of recognizing the prioritization of ACIP, but also manage that at their own local level. And then, quote, that said, I want to be very clear about schools, which, yes, ACIP has put teachers into the 1B category, the category of essential workers. But I also want to be clear that there is increasing data to suggest that schools can safely reopen, and that safe reopening does not suggest that teachers need to be vaccinated in order to reopen safely. So, when we are implementing the criteria of the advisory committee and of the state and local guidances to get vaccines across these nations, but I also want to be clear that there is increasing data to suggest that schools can safely reopen, and that safe reopening does not suggest that teachers need to be vaccinated in order to reopen safely. So while we are implementing the criteria of the advisory committee and of the state and local guidances to get vaccines across the nation, these eligible communities, I would also say that safe reopening of schools is not, that vaccination of teachers is not a prerequisite for safe reopening of schools. There it was, the head of the CDC frankly stating that science shows schools can safely reopen, and that the reopening of school does not depend on vaccinating teachers. Given the current debate in which teachers' unions, the longtime allies and benefactors of Democratic politicians from Joe Biden on down, are demanding that schools remain closed and that teachers be vaccinated before any reopening can occur, Walensky's statement was big news. Would Democratic office holders listen to the science and break with the unions? It was such big news that the White House immediately ran away from it. At the next day's briefing on February 4th, a reporter asked Press Secretary Psaki, yesterday the head of the CDC, as you know, said that it was safe to reopen schools without vaccinating teachers. You said that the White House was still wanting to, waiting for the official guidance before making a final determination. Why isn't what the director of the CDC says, why isn't that enough? Psaki said that there was a CDC guidance process going on that hadn't been completed, and she said that the president wants schools to reopen, and he wants to rely on medical experts in making decisions. And then she came back to Dr. Walensky, quote, so we're just not. Dr. Walensky spoke in her personal capacity. Obviously, she's the head of the CDC, but we're going to wait for the final guidance to come out so we can use that as a guide for schools around the country. So there it was. Dr. Walensky was speaking in her personal capacity. She is director of the CDC. She is a part of the White House COVID response team, and she was speaking on a White House teleconference. But never mind, she was speaking in her personal capacity. Now, the White House can say to the teachers' unions, don't worry, Dr. Walensky didn't really mean it. She was just speaking for herself. We're not going to cross you and announce that schools should open. You're still in charge. As for Psaki's pledge to bring, quote, truth and transparency back to the briefing room, well, perhaps she was just speaking in her personal capacity. Byron York is a chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, February 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap in Des Moines. I'm Annika Hurd from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. That brings us to the obituary section. Winnie E. Kaminga. Winnie E. Kaminga, age 95, of Crescent, Iowa, was welcomed into her Savior's arms on February 15, 2021. Winnie was born October 25, 1925, in Sioux Center, Iowa, to the late Garrett and Hattie Vanderpoel Burgers. She married Arnold Kaminga on December 1, 1947, in Dakota City, Nebraska. They were blessed with 5 daughters, Judy, Harriet, Wilda, Beth, and Janet. Winnie was a farm wife and a member of Woodland Community Bible Church. In addition to her parents, Winnie was preceded in death by her husband, Arnold Kaminga, in 1986, brothers Henry and Anthony Burgers. Winnie is survived by her daughters, Judy Ferris of Missouri Valley, Iowa, Harriet Ferris of Shelby, Iowa, Wilda McDaniel of Denison, Iowa, Beth Denton, Janet Davis, Olive Crescent, Iowa, 7 grandsons, 8 great-grandchildren, special pet dog Maddie, many nieces and nephews. Private family visitation and funeral will be held on Friday at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel, with interment following in Hazel Dell Cemetery. A public memorial service will be held at Woodland Community Bible Church at a later date. Memorial contributions are suggested to Woodland Community Bible Church. Lita M. Hammond, July 3, 1922 to February 11, 2021. Born in Neola, Iowa, preceded in death by parents Grace and Charles Cross, husband Merle H. Hammond, son Delden Hammond, siblings Gilbert Francis, Wendell Zelma Jarvis, Inez Schnicker, and Rosella Cross, sister-in-law Verdine Miller, survived by daughter Cynthia A. Burke, grandson Ian Burke, daughter-in-law Jolene Dalton, and their children Andrew, Jolene, and Kathleen, sister-in-law Florence Cross, nieces, and nephews. Visitation observing CDC guidelines Tuesday, February 16th from 12 noon to 1 p.m., followed by funeral service at 1 p.m. at the West Center Chapel. Interment, Evergreen Memorial Park. Memorials will be directed to the family. To view a live broadcast of the funeral service, go to www.hefehefe.com and click the View Live Service button on the homepage. Moving on to sports. Falcons used fast start to crush West Manoa. St. Albert used a fast start and a frenetic full-court press to roll to a 71-37 win against West Manoa in its Class 1A District Open Monday night in Council Bluffs. Quote, "We hadn't been starting well all season. We were stressed. We needed to come out with a strong start, get up on them right away," Falcon head coach Larry Peterson says. "The boys were ready." Peterson said St. Albert worked full-court pressure defense this week and, quote, "We'd fed off that, and we were lucky enough to hit the shots we needed to." Sam Rollis sat at the top of the press and led the Falcons with 19 points, many of those buckets in transition. Quote, "He's just a beast at the top," Peterson said. Jeff Miller hit 4 first-half three-pointers to help set the tone and finish with 14 points. St. Albert led 45-18 at halftime. Peterson credited guard Carter White for doing, quote, "a good job of finding open guys tonight. He was really unselfish." Landon Blatchford led West Manoa with 12 points. Next up in postseason play for the Falcons is a home district quarterfinal matchup with Woodbine at 7 p.m. on Thursday. When reached Monday night, Peterson was watching Woodbine film. Quote, "They're athletic. They're going to be a battle for sure. They'll be ready for us," he said. "Hopefully, we can play with the same intensity we had tonight. We're going to have to be disciplined on both sides of the ball." Iowa Western women win 2, men lose 1 over weekend. The Iowa Western women's basketball team won a pair of games over the weekend, scoring 92 points in both while holding their opponents to 92 points combined. How's that for symmetry? The Reavers rolled to a 92-36 win against Marshalltown Saturday at the Reaver Arena in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Western was back home on Sunday, beating Southeastern 92-56. Against Marshalltown, 4 of the Reavers' 5 starters finished in double figures, with Haley Bearfield leading the way with a game high of 17 points on a 7-of-9 shooting from the field. She added 5 assists. Gabriella Smith scored 16 points. Isnell Natabu scored 13, and Arielle McElroy scored 12. Ava Zaragova scored 10 points to lead Marshalltown. Quote, "I never thought our teamwork was awesome against Marshalltown," Reaver head coach Lindsay Van Hoof said, told Iowa Western Sports Information Team. Quote, "We were so close to breaking the program record for assist record. I was happy everyone got a chance to get in the mix and contribute." The Reavers dished out 32 assists in the win, with Jeezy Giramo leading the way with 7 assists. Burfield, McElroy, and Smith had 5 apiece. The Reavers shot 54.4% from the field and hit 14 three-pointers. According to Iowa Western Sports Information, the game was almost canceled as the Tigers awaited negative results after a COVID-19 exposure. Against Southeastern, Aria Brooks scored 15 points and grabbed 9 rebounds off the bench to lead Iowa Western. Burfield scored 13 points, while Ntabu scored 11. McElroy had 4 assists. The Reavers out-rebounded Southeastern 57-24. Anna Tue Garrett scored a game-high 17 points for Southeastern. Iowa Western improved to 7-2 on the season with wins. The Reavers returned to the court Wednesday night in a 5 p.m. game in Iowa Lakes in Estherville. Reavers men fall against Marshalltown. The Iowa Western men's basketball team saw a first-half lead evaporate in a 77-69 loss against Marshalltown on Saturday at Reaver Arena. The Reavers took a 7-point lead into the halftime break, but the Tigers answered, outscoring Iowa Western by 15 in the second half. Among the differences in the close contest was the second chance points, where Marshalltown held a 15-7 advantage. Dwayne Voss led Iowa Western with a game-high 19 points off the bench. Marcidas Leach Jr. scored 15 points, while Roland McCoy added 12. Joe Doyle had 11 rebounds. Marshalltown was led by Deonta Lagway's 16 points off the bench. Iowa Western's next plays at 7 p.m. Wednesday at Iowa Lakes. Creighton women come from behind again to defeat Georgetown. Creighton senior Tammy Carta made 2 free throws with 3 seconds left to clinch another comeback victory for the Jays, who scored the final 7 points in a 42-41 win over Georgetown on Monday. CU trailed by 6 when freshman Morgan Molly's 3-pointer cut the deficit in half, bringing her team within 41-38 at the 121 mark. It was 41-40 after Carta made 2 at the line with 22 seconds left. Then Carta won it. She was fouled on a drive to the bucket with 3.9 seconds left. She made both free throws to seal the victory. It was the second straight late-game victory for the Jays, 6-8, 5-5, who erased a 14-point deficit at Seton Hall on Saturday before winning 77-76 on Tatum Riombo's driving layup with 2 seconds left in overtime. But Rambaugh was limited Monday. Freshman Molly Morganson, who had started 6 of CU's previous 7 games, did not play. And Creighton missed that duo's playmaking presence most of the day against the Hoyas. CU started 0 of 6 from the floor, suffered through a 5-minute scoring drought in the second quarter, and knocked down just 2 shots in the third. Molly's 3-pointer with 1:21 left to play ended a 4-minute stretch without points. The Jays made just 25.5% of their shots on Monday, the lowest single-game shooting percentage since the 2016 Big East Tournament title against St. John's. The final tally, 42 points, marked the 4th time this year they failed to get up to 50, but it was the lowest final output since that 50-37 defeat to the Johnnies in 2016. Yet Creighton made the key plays in crunch time Monday, forcing 2 Georgetown turnovers and scoring 7 points in the final 90 seconds. Carta led the team with 13 points and 5 assists. Molly added 11 off the bench. Next, Gonzaga, Baylor sit atop AP Top 25. Kansas returns at number 23. The voters in the Associated Press Men's College Basketball poll are lined up with the committee that will select the NCAA tournament field when it comes to which 5 teams are the nation's best. Agreeing on the order beyond that isn't as simple. Top-ranked Gonzaga and number 2 Baylor remain atop Monday's AP Top 10, where they have been for all 13 polls this season. And after Illinois rose 1 spot to number 5, that put the top of the AP poll in sync with the initial rankings of the top 16 seeds released Saturday by the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Committee. Among teams that didn't lose last week, AP voters were a bit higher on number 7 Virginia, seeded 9th, number 9 Oklahoma, seeded 12th, number 11 Iowa, seeded 13th, and number 12 Texas, seeded 15th, following wins that came later Saturday. In addition, Alabama rose 3 spots to number 8 in the AP poll to pull closer to the committee's seeding of 7th overall shortly before the Crimson Tide scored 115 points in a win against Georgia. 6th-ranked Houston, seeded 8th, didn't play after the committee's released its rankings. The top tier. Coach Mark Few's Bulldogs received 59 of 64 first-place votes in the new AP Top 25, while Scott Drew's Bears claimed the other 5. Next came 3 straight Big Ten teams, starting with number 3 Michigan and number 4 Iowa State, as the other number 1 seeds in the selection committee rankings. Illinois climbed to the top five for the second time this season, the other coming in late November for the program's highest ranking since reaching number one during the 2004-2005 season. The Illini dropped to number 22 by January, but have won five straight, including against Iowa and number 21, Wisconsin. Rising, number 14, Creighton, had the week's biggest jump, jumping five spots over a weekend win over Villanova. The Blue Jays have won six of seven since a January 20th loss to Providence. Number 11, Iowa, climbed four spots after a pair of Big Ten wins, first against a ranked Rutgers team at home. Then came Saturday's 30-point win at Michigan State, the worst home loss in Coach Tom Izzo's tenure with the Spartans. In all, 11 teams climbed from last week's poll. Sliding, number 20th Missouri took a big tumble, falling 10 spots after a loss at Mississippi and at home to Arkansas in Southeastern Conference play last week. The Tigers had cracked the top 10 last week for the first time since December 2012. Number 15, Texas Tech, fell eight spots after losing at home to number 13, West Virginia, while number 10, Villanova, fell five spots after its loss to Creighton. Status quo. Beyond the top four, number 18, Virginia Tech, number 21, Wisconsin, and number 22, Loyola Chicago, remained in their positions from last week. Welcome. Kansas's streak-breaking absence from the top 25 was a short one. The Jayhawks fell out of last week's poll for the first time in 12 years, but they immediately beat a ranked Oklahoma State team to start the week, then added two wins over Iowa State to jump back at number 23. Kansas was one of three new additions to the week's poll, joined by number 24 Arkansas and number 25 San Diego State. It marked the Razorbacks' first appearance since January 2018, while the Aztecs spent 2 weeks in the poll in December. Conference watch. The Big 12 led the way with six ranked teams, having a national best five teams in the NCAA Selection Committee's rankings. The Big 10 was next with five ranked teams, while the SEC had four and the Atlantic Coast Conference had three. AL uses big second quarter to cruise past TJ 71-28. The Abraham Lincoln boys basketball team used a big second quarter to pull away easily in a 71-28 win against city rival Thomas Jefferson Monday night at the TJ Athletic Center in Council Bluffs. The game was close early, with TJ hanging tough. The Lynx led by one after the first quarter, but Class 4A number 4 AL flipped the switch in the second quarter, shutting the Jackets out while scoring 26 points. The Lynx cruised from there. Quote, defensively, we did a great job in the second quarter, Lynx head coach Jason Isaacson said. Throughout the first quarter, we were able to play at our pace, TJ head coach Nate Kreffel said. The second quarter was a completely different story. We turned it over several times, struggled to get stops, and AL was in full attack mode. I knew we would struggle to match their size and strength, but I was hopeful we'd take care of the ball and grind out stops. Second half was more of the same, as we struggled to end possessions with the rebound, while on the offensive end, we were never comfortable. Isaacson credited his charges for spreading the wealth offensively. Quote, our kids were unselfish and shared the ball, he said, adding, TJ has really improved since our first game, so you tip your hat to those kids. 11 Lynx that saw action scored, led by Jamison Gruber's game-high 13 points, Josh Dix scored 12, Noah Sandbeth scored 11, and Christian Tadane scored 10. Austin Schubert scored 9 points to lead TJ. Aiden Flynn added 8. The Lynx had already clinched the Missouri River Activities Conference title. The win Monday gave them a perfect 14-0 record in conference play, becoming the first team to win the league with back-to-back undefeated seasons. Next up for the Lynx is a regular season game at home against West Des Moines Dowling at 6 p.m. on Thursday. The Jackets next play at 7 p.m. on February 22nd at Sioux City West in the first round of Substate. Quote, with the regular season complete, we now focus on Sioux City West and competing up there next Monday, Kreffel said. Moving on to region and local news. Southwest Iowa's Evelyn Berkby, known for Up a Country Lane column and radio shows, dies at 101. Longtime Sydney resident Evelyn Berkby passed away February 7th at 101 years old. Berkby gained Iowa and nationwide renown as an author, radio broadcaster, and speaker on the simple joys of small town and farming life. She wrote and spoke about her family, neighbors, friends, and community, making her audience feel a part of the same. Berkby, a daughter of the Methodist minister, spent most of her formative years moving from town to town every 2 years, as ministers did at that time. She was born in Springfield, Illinois, but spent most of her early years in central and western Iowa towns, including time in Sydney when she was a senior in high school. She attended Simpsons College and received a teaching certificate, teaching grade school for a few years before taking a position running a youth program for the Methodist Church in Waterloo. She followed this career to Chicago, where she directed the youth program for the Chicago Temple. She was there during World War II and developed programs for older teens and people in their 20s. While in Chicago, she finished her 4-year degree in psychology. She then moved back to Sydney, where she married Robert Berkby in 1946, and they had 4 children, Dulcie Jean, Bob, Craig, and Jeff. Berkby got her writing start with the Evening Centennial in Shenandoah 3 years later, with the publication of her first column on November 24, 1949. Willard Archie, publisher of the Evening Centennial at the time, ran an ad that he was looking for a woman who lived on a farm to write a column. During Berkby's interview, Archie suggested that she include a recipe in her column because people would always like recipes. Thus, Up a Country Lane, Follow a Column was born, and Berkby never looked back, writing columns for 70 years, including a recipe in almost every one. Those columns ran in the Evening Centennial, which later became the Valley News, every week for all of that time. For her family, including a recipe each week with her column meant a lot of taste testing, with a bowl of cornflakes waiting for them in the kitchen if the recipe did not turn out well. Quote, "We're certainly very proud of her for having stuck with this for so long and made this an important part of her life," said Bob Berkby, Evelyn's oldest son. Quote, "Growing up, there was always a typewriter going on in our house." Of course, this also meant that her children themselves were often the object of her columns, and occasionally, Bob or his brothers or their father had to pinch hit and write a column for Evelyn. Quote, "There were times when, for instance, soon after she started writing her column a few months later, I was born," said Bob. "That week, my dad wrote the column while my mom was in the hospital giving birth to me." Bob said Evelyn encouraged the boys to write a column after returning from long trips, too. Quote, "Mom would always encourage us to write them, and people want to know what you've been up to," said Bob. He joked that they suspected she wanted a week off. Evelyn's columns was a touchstone for her sons, and the children of many Midwest wives who read her columns and later heard her Down a Country Lane radio program on KMA Radio, as well as a program called Radio Homemakers that aired on KMA and KFNF, and the Kitchen Clatter program. Evelyn and others like her joined those programs in the 1950s, a kind of second generation of mothers and housewives. For the boys, the columns and radio programs were a window into what their mother was doing and what she was thinking while they were away. For the Midwestern small town and the farm youth away at a college or a job, they were a taste of home. Quote, "It sort of gave us an awareness of a bigger world out there because she was so connected with readers all over the Midwest," said Bob. "As we got older, we started going off in the summers to find adventures further and further from the Midwest, but always felt a strong connection through her columns." When Evelyn's eyesight started to fail at the age of about 95, she started dictating her column to Bob, and he would type and submit them to the newspaper. Her final column appeared in the Valley News on Wednesday, November 27, 2019, but with Bob's help, she continued writing a few lines to go with her favorite columns through the years, which still appeared in the Valley News. Evelyn was welcomed into the 50-year club at the Iowa Newspaper Association Convention in February 8, 2018, in Des Moines as one of the longest-tenured columnists in American newspaper history. Later that same year, she, at the inspirational age of 98, was holding book signings for her book, Through a Country Town, first in her chronology of life in and around Fremont County. That book included her recollections of Sydney, as it was 1935 when she and her family moved to the town she was a senior in high school. Evelyn wrote 12 books in all, including Up a Country Lane Cookbook, Neighboring on the Air, Always Put in a Recipe, Witching for William, Alone Through England and Scotland, Our Corey Family Records, Our Berkby Family Heritage, Cooking with KMA, Festival Cookie Book, Come Again Cookie Book, History of the Sydney, Iowa United Methodist Church, and Through a Country Town. Evelyn's column was named after the long lane that ran from the road where the mailbox sat to their farmhouse. She described the mailbox as her window to the world. She would mail her columns to the newspaper each week and, in return, receive mail from readers of her columns all over the country that identified with her stories and her. Bob said Evelyn was aware of her family and community and always had her column on her mind. He said that she looked for ways to share about what was important about small towns, farms, and families. Quote, I enjoyed sharing, said Evelyn in an earlier interview. It was part of my life. Throughout her life, Evelyn also expressed and shared with her readers and listeners a continuing optimism that, quote, today is going to be a good day, that optimism and joy in life can be seen in her columns and books and heard in her programs. Bob added, quote, Mom loved neighboring, connecting with people and sharing real-life joys, sorrows, and everyday activities. With her broadcasts, columns, and books, she shared the values of Midwestern towns and farms. Her message was always of optimism, caring, and understanding, radiating out to encompass readers and listening from across the nation. For her family, it was just Mom being Mom. She was at the typewriter an hour or two a day and went often to the radio studios in Shenandoah for broadcasts. For better or for worse, we were the guinea pigs when she tested new recipes before printing them or putting them on the air. Best of all, she infused us with a confidence, an openness to others, and a delight in neighboring what we continued to share. Evelyn may be done writing, but her columns, books, and radio history will live on for many, as that taste of simple life they still remember or always yearn for. Evelyn's favorite recipe, hay hand rolls. 1 cup of lukewarm water, 1 tablespoon of dry yeast, 1 teaspoon of sugar, 6 cups of lukewarm water, 4 cups of white flour, 1 cup of salad oil, 1 cup of sugar, 1 tablespoon of salt, and 2 eggs, optional. Additional flour to make a soft dough. Dissolve yeast in a 1 cup lukewarm water with 1 teaspoon of sugar added. When the mixture is bubbly, add 4 cups of lukewarm water and 4 cups of flour. Mix well and let the mixture set, covered, in a draft-free place until mixture bubbles up, making a sponge. Add oil, sugar, salt, and eggs. Combine well. Gradually add enough flour to make a soft dough. Turn out onto a floured breadboard and knead until smooth, adding a little more flour if needed. Place in a greased bowl, or 2. This is a large recipe. Turn the dough to grease on all sides, then cover and let rise until double in bulk. Take out the portion of dough you want to bake immediately. Put the remainder, covered, in the refrigerator for another day. Knead the bread you kept out on a floured board for 4 or 5 minutes until dough is smooth and springs back in your fingers. Shape your loaves or rolls into whatever shape you wish. Put into greased pans and let rise until doubled. Bake in a 375-degree oven for about 20 to 30 minutes or nicely brown on top. Turn out onto a cooling rack and keep the bottom from sweating and coat the top with butter for a tender crust. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, February 16th, 2021. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Annika Hurd from Drake University in Des Moines, and thank you so much for listening.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish, short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers from Dubuque. Don Dwebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers' strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Dwebar, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwebar." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Torkelson.